Gareth Porter is a historian and investigative journalist specializing in U.S. foreign and military policy. His articles on U.S. policy in Iran have appeared on Op-Ed News, Antiwar.com, Interpress News Service, and Counterpunch, and he's been a guest on this program many, many times. In 2011, he received the Martha Gellhorn Prize for his articles on Afghanistan. He's the author of 5 books, of which the latest is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, published last year, which we have spoken to him about. He is recently back from Vienna, where he was monitoring the recently concluded negotiations with Iran and the P5+1 nations to reduce Iran's nuclear enrichment program in exchange for relieving Iran from U.S.-led sanctions. Welcome once again, Gareth Porter, who takes on the world.
Hello again, Jeff. Glad to be back.
Good to have you back here. In today's New York Times, I notice there's a report that the Iranian legislature has decided to wait 80 days before giving its approval to the Iran nuclear deal, presumably to see how the U.S. Congress votes on the measure. In view of a recent article of yours at antiwar.com, which points to Iran's successes in maintaining its nuclear enrichment program despite opposition to it in this country, and from Israel, of course, it would seem like a smart move on Iran's part and not one taken out of weakness.
Well, generally speaking, I agree with that assessment that that Iran has gotten an agreement that meets its minimum requirements for security, and really, more importantly, or at least equally importantly, I should say, is in accord with its national dignity. I mean, this is, of course, a major theme that the Iranians have sounded frequently over the years. And I think, you know, what they were trying to get, of course, was a lifting of sanctions that are nuclear related. They obviously would like to have gotten all the sanctions lifted under the agreement, but that was not going to be possible. And so they did get the sanctions, unilateral and multilateral sanctions, lifted that were imposed because of the supposedly because of the nuclear program, and at the same time, through this agreement they've achieved the legitimacy of their nuclear program, and those are the two things that the Iranians were really trying to accomplish for years through diplomacy, and I think one has to. If you're going to be honest about the appraisal of the significance of this agreement, you have to acknowledge the reality that they did, in fact, accomplish something that they had set out to accomplish many, many years ago through diplomacy.
Well, back in 2003, I believe it was, yes, 2003, the Iranian government made overtures to the George W. Bush administration to talk about minimizing their program and actually reestablishing perhaps relations, and that was rejected, and instead we had the axis of evil. Perhaps you could bring us back to that.
Right. I mean, you're alluding to the fact, a very important historical fact that has been dropped, not just dropped, never introduced into the narrative about the Iranian nuclear program or these negotiations, which is that the Iranian government did, in fact, negotiate with the European three, the UK, France, and Germany, from 2003 to 2005. And at that point, of course, the Bush administration was refusing to join in any negotiations. The EU3 were pushing the United States at that point to become involved because they knew that ultimately there would be no possibility of reaching a meaningful agreement with Iran on its nuclear program as long as the U.S. was refusing to negotiate. So that was part of the tension that was going on. But the point that I know you're alluding to is that present Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, who was then Deputy Foreign Minister, was actually involved in directly in negotiations and formulated a proposal to the European three that offered to limit the Iranian nuclear program. And bear in mind, in 2003, they had not yet begun to do any enrichment of uranium. They had only tested their centrifuges. That's all they had been able to accomplish. But they had planned, obviously, to go ahead and enrich uranium, and they were offering to limit the scale of their enrichment to a very low level. So it was obviously a good deal for the United States and the Europeans, and the Europeans recognized that, at least some of the Europeans who were present when it was proposed, recognized that this was a good deal and they should snap it up and negotiate on it. But the Bush administration, as I think you suggested a moment ago, said, no, you know, we don't want you to negotiate with the Iranians on anything that would allow the Iranians to have a single centrifuge spinning. This was the language that then, I believe, Undersecretary of State Robert, sorry, I've forgotten his last name now, the guy who was in charge of weapons of mass destruction, he made that statement to Director General of the IAEA, Alberdi, in 2007 or sometime around then. Not a single centrifuge should spin at that point. And so that was the end of that round of negotiations. And it wasn't really until 2013 that the United States agreed to negotiate with Iran on the basis of accepting that there would be some a nuclear program to negotiate over. That is to say that the United States did not insist that Iran totally eliminate all enrichment of uranium. So that's why, again, I think the Iranians can rightly point to the fact that they have achieved the legitimacy of their nuclear program.
Also, it's become apparent that the sanctions, the enforcement of sanctions on Iran, is specifically an American operation, really pushed by Israel and its friends in the United States, because we read in the papers the concern that all these European countries, companies and businesses are going to rush to Iran to do business. And then American companies might be well left out of that. But it's quite interesting that when those who speak about free markets in other areas want to close it when it comes to Iran for geopolitical reasons, quite opposed to the idea of opening a country for let's say American business. Maybe you could comment on that.
Well, first of all, yes, the origin of the international sanctions, multilateral sanctions against Iran, against the nuclear program, were indeed pressure from the Israelis through the U.S. government, and particularly the Treasury Department, which is a very strong center for Israeli influence within the executive branch of the United States. It was the Treasury Department which was in charge of the planning of the whole strategy for sanctions against Iran, for leveraging those sanctions against banking, the banking sector of Iran in particular, as a form of pressure on the Iranian government. And so that is indeed the reason that we got the international sanctions regime that was put into effect in 2012. The Europeans came along with more or less reluctance. Certainly, the European Union, which agreed to participate in these sanctions, was deeply divided, and a number of European member states were extremely dependent on Iranian oil and made significant sacrifices to go along with this under terrific political pressure from the European three, the UK, France, and Germany. And I'm talking here about Greece, Italy, Spain. These are the three countries that were most heavily dependent on Iranian oil. So they did not want this to happen, but they caved in, from the position of economic weakness in the face of pressure from their allies, which in turn reflected pressure from Washington.
Which in turn reflected pressure from the Israel lobby. The Treasury has become almost an Israeli fiefdom. Stuart Levy, who was the Treasury Secretary, who I believe the first one to start implementing the sanctions, when he left office after Obama's administration, I recall he went over to Israel and told Prime Minister Netanyahu not to worry about a thing. Everything would still be in place with the next appointee, who happened to be, I think, David Cohen, another very pro-Israel, openly pro-Israel appointee. And it seems to be like Jacob Lew. It seems to be this particular seat in the U.S. government is reserved for a pro-Israel partisan.
And indeed, I've noticed that myself, that, in fact, you know, I understand that the origin of the whole Office of Terrorism Finance and Intelligence, which has been on the forefront of justifying anti-Iran policies and anti-Hezbollah policies on the part of the United States, you know, was set up in 2004. At the behest of the Israeli lobby. It was a very strong lobbying effort that accomplished that piece of legislation. And that, of course, was a major shift, that represented a major shift in terms of the politics of the executive branch with regard to these issues, in the sense that there was now an office that was dedicated wholly to collecting information and putting out propaganda, essentially, that would justify continuation and hardening of U.S. policies against Iran and its allies in the region. So, I mean, that certainly is a part of the story. And by the way, I've sometime recently, I can't remember the exact date, published a story illustrating how that office in the Treasury Department has shamelessly peddled the Mossad line about the supposed Hezbollah influence, and in fact even a Hezbollah terrorist cell in Nigeria, which of course was a complete fabrication. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever behind it, and finally, you know, the story sort of collapsed and was rejected by a Nigerian court. But in the meantime, Treasury put out this propaganda line, and it was picked up by major news outlets and continued to, you know, represent the understanding of the news media about this issue.
Well, it's interesting that we constantly hear our politicians talk about Iran being the leading sponsor of state terror in the region, and you look around and right next door is Saudi Arabia, but they never give examples. They don't give examples at all. So it's become like an accepted fact that Iran is the leading sponsor of state terror in the Middle East, when in fact Iran is fighting against ISIS and is providing weapons and support for the fight against ISIS in Syria as well as Iraq, which does not seem to be acknowledged by the same people. It's like repeat a lie long enough, people will accept it as fact. But I've yet to see any example of Iranian-sponsored terror in the Middle East. The Houthis are being supported in the Saudi Arabia, but they're Yemenis. They're not Iranians.
Well, Jeff, I couldn't agree more that this is a perfect example of this principle that you repeat a lie often enough, and it is accepted as the truth. And I mean, you know, the way it works in American politics and foreign policy is that the Israeli lobby gets certain point of view enacted into law. In this case, it was to get Iran on the list of terrorist states in 1997, as I recall, and then ultimately to get Hezbollah listed as a terrorist organization, and then to simply continue to cite those two things either explicitly or simply by implication, by reference. I think this is precisely what this continued Obama administration line accusing Iran of being a state sponsor of terrorism, a supporter of terrorism in the region. That's what it's all about. I mean, it's a syllogism, that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, Hamas is a terrorist organization, and therefore an Iranian support for them, whether it's material or otherwise, is support for terrorism in the region, and therefore that's the basis for this continued repetition of the line. But I must say that it is clearly time that people who care about the truth and people who care about sort of trying to at least reduce the degree to which the United States is contributing to the destabilization and violence in the Middle East, it's time for them to step up and demand that this hoary old line be reviewed officially by the Obama administration in its remaining time in office, because it's clear that this designation should be lifted, especially in light of the fact that the State Department has taken the Mujahideen-e-Khalq off the list of organizations which are considered terrorist organizations on the ground that they did not find any evidence that it had carried out terrorist actions for many years. And however one may view Hezbollah or Iran, there has not been any evidence of Hezbollah or Iranian terrorism for many, many years. And that is certainly a very relevant point in evaluating and in calling for the revision of that official designation on the part of the Obama administration.
You mentioned the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. This is a group of Iranians that was supporting Iraq during the Iraq-Iran war and committed a number of terrorist acts inside Iran.
Well, that's right. I mean, they were certainly serving the Saddam Hussein regime during the Iran-Iraq war. They had moved out of Iran, where they had been carrying out terrorist actions against the Islamic Republic in the early 1980s. And they were obviously, pursued relentlessly by the Iranian government. So they moved to Iraq and became the client of the Saddam Hussein regime. And when that when the Saddam Hussein regime was then removed in 2003, by that time the Mujahideen-e-Khalq had already made an arrangement with Mossad to become its client. That had begun really in the 1990s. Certainly as early as the 1997, 1998, and probably earlier than that. So this is an organization that has both been a terrorist organization and has served repeatedly as a sort of a client to carry out various activities on behalf of Middle Eastern states.
Such as the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists.
Well, that's an open question, whether it was the MEK or the Mossad itself. I tend to believe that those operations were too sensitive for the Mossad to leave it to an MEK operation. Mm-hmm. I don't think, frankly, Mossad believes that the MEK would be trustworthy enough to carry out something like that. So I think those assassinations were all carried out by Mossad itself.
But they couldn't be called terrorist acts because of who's carrying them out.
Right.
It's interesting. I mentioned this once before, but the way the mainstream media collaborates in the demonization of Hezbollah, they never report that it has been an alliance now for a number of years with the leading Maronite Christian organization. Well, actually several of them, and that it's an alliance with the former president Michel Aoun, former general Michel Aoun, who I spoke with in 2007, who told me frankly, if it was not for Hezbollah, Israel would take over Lebanon. And we never see in the American press about the origins of Hezbollah in response to the Israeli invasion. This has been that whole invasion and the casualties of what it caused the people of Lebanon is erased from history, at least as reported by the U.S. media.
Yes, and this is part of a broader problem, which I have continued to see over the years play out in news media coverage of the Middle East, which is that there is no context whatsoever, there's no historical context or geopolitical context for the coverage of current developments. And so every time Israel says something new, every time the Obama administration says something new having to do with Iran and the region, there is no sense of how things developed to the point of where they are now. And that applies, of course, to the question of Hezbollah's role in Lebanon, the fact that Hezbollah continues to bear arms, to have the most powerful non-state military and possibly the most powerful military of anywhere outside the Middle East, outside of Israel and Iran. It's a very powerful military organization, very effective, and the reason it is there is indeed to prevent Israel from rolling up southern Lebanon and indeed taking over. I mean, if they did that, there would be nothing to stop them from taking over Beirut and installing some client regime. So it is indeed, the only thing that stands in the way of a complete regime change at the hands of Israel and a total revision of the political map of the Middle East. And the implications of that would be, even more importantly, that the Israelis would then have a relatively free hand to attack Iran without much fear of paying a high cost. And this, the Israelis have said this explicitly and publicly over the years. What they are afraid of more than the relatively small missile of conventional missile force armed with conventional weapons in Iran is the thousands and thousands of missiles and rockets which the Hezbollah disposes of, which could be rained down on Israeli cities. And so if they wrap up, if they were to defeat Hezbollah and wrap up the Lebanese territory, Iran would be exposed to an immediate and serious threat of attack by Israel, and of course it would not be merely against the nuclear program. It would be a broad attack trying to weaken the Iranian state and if possible to bring about regime change. So this is Hezbollah plays an absolutely key role in the fundamental the peace that has now been established in the region between Iran, Lebanon, and Israel over the last decade or so.
My guest is Gareth Porter. We're talking about Iran and now most recently Hezbollah. I mentioned in the first part of my program this morning before I called you, I spoke about the all-out assault on the Iran deal being launched by Netanyahu, being carried out by what I call Israel front groups in the United States, groups that don't mention Israel in the name, such as the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Foreign Policy Initiative, and so on. The Washington Institute has become almost quasi-governmental organization. It has really infiltrated itself into the inner sanctums of Congress, and it put out a paper on June 24th, which I mentioned that Tom Friedman related to as if it was a tablet from Mount Sinai. And this morning, I don't know if you saw his editorial, his op-ed this morning, in which he called for the recommendation in this recommendation by the Washington Institute that the U.S. should go on record as threatening to bomb Iran without warning or negotiation should it find that it is working on a bomb or has developed a bomb. It's extraordinary for Friedman, who just a few years ago said that the Israel lobby had bought and paid for Congress. But I guess he's found out that there's certain things he can say and not say.
Yeah, and of course, there's nothing new about that idea. This is what the Netanyahu government has been trying to get the United States to agree to for years now. I mean, going back explicitly to 2011, 2012, when you know, Netanyahu and then Defense Minister Ehud Barak were offering after putting on a full court press of pressure on the Obama administration during the 2012 presidential campaign. Netanyahu and Barak then said that they were willing to agree to stop demanding that the Obama administration go along with what it was asking it to do, as long as it said the Obama administration would say that it would give an ultimatum to Iran. Or an implicit ultimatum to Iran that it would have certain amount of time to agree to the red lines that the Israeli government had put forward. So, I mean, I just want to make the point very strongly that this has been a consistent policy. It's not always articulated clearly or explicitly, but it has been there at least for the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, I've mentioned also that the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, and he defines the term ubiquitous. I find him everywhere. I thought he was maybe the first successful human clone because he seems to be in every organization, founding or advisory board and so on. And he writes these very thoughtful op-ed pieces that appear in the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, about the Iranian situation, for example. And then at the very end, he always includes that the military option must not only be on the table, but must be established as U.S. policy.
Right, and now the latest thing that he's done is to say that the U.S. ought to be providing B-52s to Israel, as he puts it, to deter, quote-unquote, Iran. And, I mean, this is so laughable that it hardly merits mention except as an amusing indication of just how far to the right Dennis Ross is going at this point.
It's interesting, I have to say, when Ross was working for George Bush Sr., he came back to his hometown, San Francisco, and spoke at a synagogue that he had gone to when he was a young man. And they were ready to lynch him because he was working for Bush, and people in the audience were so much further to the right than Ross was. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary scene. He got lucky to get out alive.
Yeah.
But he knows he has another book coming out. He's written a number of books. And if you go through them, there's a lot of good information in them. But at the end, he comes back to the same thing about the right to attack Iran. I had spoken, most of the morning I devoted to the fact that we were seeing an unprecedented assault on the American body politic, on the President of the United States, by a foreign country in which he has enlisted the U.S. Congress and a number of front organizations. And I referred back to 1981 when AIPAC was virtually alone in going against President Reagan over the sale of AWACS, airborne warning system planes, to Saudi Arabia. And Reagan had to get on the phone and twist Charles Percy's arm to get him to switch his vote. So the deal passed 51-49. And
right.
this is a much bigger deal. And they have 2 months in order to get this done. Today, I had mentioned at 5:30, 2:30 here, there's going to be this rally in New York. It's really designed to pressure Charles Schumer to come out publicly now and saying he will vote against the deal. New York Post editorial had an extraordinary editorial, part of which I read on my program the other day, in which it just demanded, as a patriot, calling on his conscience and his commitment to his country to vote against the President of the United States on behalf of a foreign power. It's extraordinary the degree to which this country has become occupied.
This is indeed the crunch time on this question of whether we are going to have even the slightest degree of independence on this question. I agree. And let me just add one point, though, and that is that what I find most distressing, apart from the danger that does, in fact, face the agreement in the Senate, that you've alluded to, is that what we have been given in the news media and, you know, in terms of the Obama administration's line about this agreement is that we have a choice between two horrible horrible possibilities. One, we've been told this. We've been told we have a choice between either Iran getting a nuclear weapon, or three choices. We have Iran gets a nuclear weapon, or we have this agreement, or if neither of those, then we have war. We have war in order to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. So those are the three choices that the Obama administration and the news media have put forward, and the Israelis have only a slightly, well, it's not slightly different, but they have a different choice, and that is that we have only two choices, and that is we either go to war or Iran gets a nuclear weapon. And so, I mean, really, this country has been subjected to one of the most Orwellian presentations of a matter of war and peace in its history. And I think this has to be a matter that we respond to very strongly. Everybody who cares about the truth and who cares about war and peace has to go to bat to say, look, this is a lie, that this is not the choice at all. I mean, there was always a choice of simply agreement with Iran that did not involve the threat of a nuclear weapon. It was simply a matter of trading limitations on Iran's nuclear program in return for lifting sanctions and legitimizing their nuclear program. That was the real choice. And so I just want to make that point, which I'm afraid, you know, is obscured by just everything that anyone sees or reads if you pay attention to the news media.
Well, I'm glad you made that point. I wanted to point out your book, Manufactured Crisis, really goes into the background of the lies that have been spread about Iran by the U.S. government and by these what I call Israel front groups, which they're essentially fronts for Israel that operate with tax exempt status, extraordinarily, and you go. To find your work, go to GarethPorter.com?
No, it's my writing now is primarily at Middle East Eye, which it's www.MiddleEastEye.net, and also at Truthout, truthout.org, www.truthout.org. And those are the two places where I publish most of my stuff, although I can occasionally get something elsewhere. I'm still working on it.
I find them in different places of the net, so just go to Gareth Porter, even latest articles. It's amazing read. Thanks so much, Gareth, for being our guest today. I look forward to speaking with you the next time, which I'm sure will be fairly soon.
Thanks again, John.
Take care. Bye-bye.